Mr. Shaw, Reel 6. Now, after these first two convoys, what happened next?
Well, we called in to Plymouth, and this would have been, been at the end of November or December sometime, and we had to have a degaussing. You've heard of the degaussing. We had to have those cables fitted round the ships. It was going to take a good while, so we were, I think we were in Plymouth for about 4 weeks, and we were given each watch, I think it was 11 days leave. You know, when you got in, if anything like this happened, they tried to give you leave when they could. So we were given, I think it was 11 days leave, but anyway, it doesn't matter. At the time, I was engaged, and my girlfriend lived in Guernsey because her father was a lighthouse keeper and he was on SAC. So we arranged then to get married. So when it came to my turn to go on leave, I was a second leave, which happened in, January, obviously, because we got married on the 31st of January, 1940. And I got married in Guernsey, in St. Samson's Church, Guernsey. The one and only time I've ever been in that church, believe it or believe it not. And then she came back with me to Plymouth, and we stayed in Plymouth for a bit longer, or Devonport, anyway, Devonport. Then where did we go? We went up to Scapa Flow. And I think this would probably be around about February or March time. I can't pinpoint it exactly, but February or March time. And this is where we come to the bit about this stoker I'll tell you about with the football. While we were there, we were at 4 hours' notice for steam. In other words, ready to move in 4 hours.
So what did that involve then?
Well, that meant that really nobody could be off the ship for more than 4 hours without the special permission of the captain. Or if you were off, you were able to get back within 4 hours. So at the time, a football match was arranged between the ship, the Resolution, and the French fleet, which was, I think, consisted of six destroyers, I'm not sure about this, but six little boats that were in. And they'd arranged it, and we were going to play this on Greenock Morton's football ground. You've heard of Greenock Morton, the football team, playing on their ground. Lovely pitch. Right, so in this particular match, I was playing, you see. And this chap, Lightning, a young stoker, he was 1940, I was, at that particular time, I was still only 21. That's right, I was coming up for 22. And if I remember rightly, he was only 18 or 19. He was a couple of years younger than me. And as I told you earlier on, I thought I could play football till I saw him. Anyway, we played this game, and of course there were one or two of the Greenock Morton officials watching the match, and we won 6-2, I think. And he scored about four goals, I forget exactly now. Anyway, after the match, the officials approached the captain or someone through to get to the captain and asked permission for this young lad to play for Greenock Morton first 11 on the Saturday, that's if the ship was still there, of course, against, I forget who they were playing, Queen of the South, I think they were playing, I remember this. And we were still in on Saturday, and he was given special permission. Although the ship was 4 hours' notice, he was given special permission to play, and Greenock Morton won 4-0, and he scored a hat trick. This was a young stoker playing for a professional. In those days, anybody could play for, as you know, for anybody. Yeah, but unfortunately, after that, we left, and we headed for Narvik. We relieved the war spite. Now, what year? It was April, wasn't it, at the war? That's right, it was April that the war spiked, and those big destroyers and all that. Well, we relieved the war spite at Narvik. And we had lots and lots of air raids, but...
What do you remember of that?
Oh, well, quite comical in a way. It was and it wasn't, because the air raid system in those days was a bit antiquated. They didn't have raid, you know, it hadn't been developed properly. And luckily for us, the planes couldn't dive down because of the Norwegian fields, so they had to drop their bombs from way up. And quite often, we might, two or three of us might be on the deck, on the forecastle or something, getting a bit of fresh air. And you could see the bombs coming down before the alarm went. And we'd all dive, you know, at the time. And we had, oh, terrible. I think we were there 28 days and averaged 30 air raids a day, so you can work that out. Well, the other way around. Anyway, it came to over 800 air raids, but we were only hit once, quarter deck. We got hit with a bomb, the resolution, on the quarter deck, and it was a 500-pound bomb. And oddly enough, where it went through the quarter deck, it was just a clean hole, as though someone had... sawn a clean hole out, but of course it exploded 1, 2, 3 decks down, I think. It went through the Marines' deck, but luckily there was nobody, none of the Marines were there anyway at the time, and exploded on the deck below. And I think there was only one casualty, someone happened to be in that area at the time, and it did a bit of damage, but it didn't prevent the ship from doing its job. And but to get back to this lightning chat, now this is what you call Sod's Law, isn't it? One of these raids we're telling you about, when we all used to watch the bombs, and we all used to dive, and some of them would dive under the 15-inch turret. Get under there, you see. And of course, you get the height of the ship's side, If a bomb missed, and they nearly all did miss, luckily for us, the shrapnel would go, well, you know, hit the ship's side, but being a battleship, didn't do a lot of damage. But some of the shrapnel would come over. And this young stoker was lying in on the turret, and right next to him, talking to you about Reg Wells, next to him, and a bit of shrapnel hit him, guess where? In the leg, and he had to have his leg amputated. Great footballer. He would have been a professional footballer. And I don't know what happened to him after that. But, yeah. I always remember that. That was a real shocker. And not only was he a good footballer, he was a nice chap with it. He wasn't big-headed or anything. But there you are. These things happened. And we were in Narvik, as I say, about a month. And when we left... Oh, we bombed... Oh, that was when the 15-inch were fired in real anger.
What do you remember that? What were you aiming at, basically?
Well, we were aiming at Narvik, the German troops, you see. And what amused us, in a funny sort of a way at the time, was that... I think it was the 6 o'clock news in the evening. I'm not sure now. And one of the well-known announcers, Bruce Belfridge, or one of that lot, you probably heard those names, well-known announcer, was announcing that the Germans were seen fleeing from Narvik.
What?
And we went to action stations, and we bombarded, you know, 15-inch shells bombarding Narvik, because the Germans had just arrived in, and they took... So from then on, I never believed anything I heard on our radio. I didn't. I mean, whether anybody else did or not, I don't know. Because to me, we were there at the time, you see. But anyway, that's the only time that we bombarded with a 15-inch. And once again, all the nuts and bolts. And then we, just after that, we left, I think the following day. And where did we go then? Did we go back to Scapa? Let me think now. By this time, it's the end of April, May.
Would you have to go and get the quarterdeck area fixed?
Well, no, they didn't fix it then. They left it for the time. I think what happened was that we... What did we do? I can't remember whether that was... I think we went back to Scapa Flow first, but I'm not certain about that. I think we did. And then from there, down to Gibraltar.
Now, were you joining the Mediterranean fleet, or...?
No. Well, I'm saying no, but we went to Gibraltar. We went to Gibraltar, and we laid alongside. We were alongside doing nothing for ages and ages. And it was then that I left the ship. And that was June 1940, the end of June 1940, when I left it.
And they were just sitting in harbour, I suppose.
That's right. But they did move eventually up after I'd gone, because I'd heard about it later on from my friends and so forth. So I left in... June 1940, and then they had a little ship in Gibraltar, similar to the very ancient ones, like the Victory, only not as big as the Victory, but one of the real old time, where people would go temporarily while they were waiting to see where they had to go, if you get what I mean. So I was on there for a couple of weeks, I think, and then... I was detailed to go to one of the old... You've heard of the V&W destroyers, have you? Well, this was the Volunteer destroyer, which was heading back from Gibraltar with another ship. I can't remember the other one. And with a little convoy to Plymouth. So I joined the Volunteer as a passenger mainly, not I wasn't part of the ship's company, but while I was there, I did watchkeeping to help out the others. But the main thing about that was, I was on the Volunteer for 7 days, and for 7 days, I didn't eat or drink anything. 7 days. And in the end, I was so sick, I was bringing up blood. Because it happened to be rough, you see. And I'd been on a big battleship before that, and this was a destroyer. It's true. I couldn't get anything down, not even the old biscuits. Couldn't keep it down. Drop of water occasionally, but say in the end I was bringing blood, coughing up blood. Anyway, but I still had to go on watch. I mean, I couldn't have cared if the ship had blown up. I didn't know what I was doing, really. Anyway.
Well, what was it like on board... You know, on board ship. How did conditions compare with a battleship?
Oh, no comparison. It was, you know, sort of all enclosed and... I mean, I wasn't in a fit state to care anyway, to be quite honest. I wasn't really.
Was it much wetter? I mean...
Yes, the seas coming over and all that. And when you... to go on watch, you had a sort of... what's the right phrase? Take your life in your hands, you see. You had a great big seas coming and a ship... And up, this was the bit that did it, the up and down movement, and coming down and shuddering. This was the worst. Anyway, eventually we got to Plymouth, and my wife was there, Plymouth, because she'd been... She was
this
still
would
there.
Be late June or early July?
This would be, about late June, early July time, round about, roughly. And... I reported then to the barracks in Devonport at the time I had to go, and then I was informed that I had to get so-and-so trained to Chatham Barracks, because Chatham was my depot. So my wife came with me, so I went in the Chatham Barracks, and... I wasn't in there very long. And draft ship to the Harvester, which was in Liverpool at the time, Gladstone Dock, Liverpool.
So you joined her in July?
I got a feeling it was probably about the very beginning of August. But anyway, end of July, beginning of August.
And what was she doing in Gladstone Dock?
Well, she'd just come in from a... there were six of those ships initially built for the Brazilian Navy. There was the Havant, Harvester, Highlander, Hesperus, Hurricane, Havelock. Six. And the Havant was sunk at an evacuation of when the troops had been evacuated. The Havant was gone already, so there were only five left by then. The Harvester was built in Barrow in Furness, and I think she'd only done a couple of trips round, you know, working.
Could you describe the ship? You know, give us an idea of what it was like above and below decks.
Well, I liked it on there actually, but our mess, the RA's mess, was up high up and near the bridge, and when we were in a rough sea in the Atlantic, the seas used to come way over the top, you know, and you'd get, you know, where all the leads were going to water come through into the mess and all, but so this would happen. And the first trip I did on the Harvester, and that was not long after I joined it, only two or three days, and we went in. The convoys hadn't been organised properly then, and so we used to go out sort of searching for U-boats or something. And another 7 days, and the same thing happened again. I didn't eat or drink for another 7 days, believe it or believe it not. Yeah, so that was twice. Two destroyers. So I, once again, I couldn't care less whether a torpedo. I mean, I wasn't interested. I was on watch, but somebody was on watch with me at the time, the chief ERA, because it was all new to me. You see. But the amazing thing about it was, and when we're out for about 7 days, we came back into Liverpool. The next trip, I was all right, and before long, and within a few weeks, you could have put a greasy pork chop in front of me, and I'd have eaten it, and the ship could be rolling all over the show, and I couldn't care less. So there you are. So I don't know what it's all about. I always sympathise with people who are seasick. I'll tell you that.
So what was the mess deck like? It is the ERA mess.
Well, the ERA mess. We had the. Let me see. We had the chief ERA in there, and 1, 2, 3 ERAs, so that's four, and one usually on loan from a depot, five, and then we had the messman, the chap, and that was always be a stoker who'd look after our, you know, get your food up and make sure the mess, everything was clean.
And what was it like physically? I mean, could you describe the room? If
all, well, it was very small, I should say. It would be about, just trying to visualise it. I suppose the area would be, if you take up to about there, be about that area.
About 12 foot square, 10 foot
yeah,
square.
I should say about that. You didn't get the height, you know, it wasn't as high as this up there. It was only just, let me see, I've been, the deck above would be about
6 foot then,
yeah, probably, or just maybe six or something like that. And of course we all had hammocks at the time. Then you had the lockers were around the side there and there, so there were 1, 2, 3, 4, I think there were five lockers, and we each had a locker, and all your gear was in the locker, you see. And of course when they very often, and then the locker would have a sort of bit of a cushion on top. And but when the water, when we're in a rough sea, and you used to get them very often in the Atlantic. And but you just got used to it. That's all. And the ship would be rolling over like this and jumping up. And I have you heard of the game Toe-topoly? Not Monopoly. Well, Toe-topoly was similar, except that it was horse racing. And I had a game in this at the time, and you had the horses were, you know, just cut out figures in a cardboard, not cardboard, sort of wooden block, but that used to slide all over the show. So I made some rubber ones to fit in, and the ship could really be up nearly 45 degrees and they still wouldn't slide off. So we used to be able to play a few games occasionally, though. But we used to go in and out of Liverpool.
And well, hang on a minute. What about the engines, the engine rooms, the boiler rooms? They'd be very different from the...
Oh, yeah. Well, it was all modern in those days compared to the resolution, obviously, because the ships had only just been built in 1940.
And what engine system was it? How did it all work?
Well, it was similar, except that there were only, instead of being 18 boilers, there were only two.
Was it oil or diesel or what?
Oil. And it was superheated steam. In other words, dry steam, where it's reheated, they had what they call superheaters in there. And
how did that work? I mean,
well, you had the initial steam would then go through some more tubes, which were called the superheaters, which were heated again, which took practically all the moisture out, so that you've got just pure steam then aiming at the turbines. And of course this prevented a lot of corrosion, etc. So instead of having a lot of water coming, sometimes you get water carried over and that do a lot of damage, but this prevented that, you see. So in those days it was something really a new innovation, the superheated steam, you see. And the engine room, practically all the valves and whatnot were named in Portuguese because they were built for the Brazil. But of course we knew what they were anyway. I mean, we all knew that was supposed to do this and that was supposed to. So regardless of what language it was in, the ordinary telegraph from the bridge, you know, where they used to ring down, that was in English. Stop, slow ahead, half ahead, full ahead, half astern. That was all in English. Or the number of revolutions to do. You know, it'd ring down from the bridge up 20 revolutions. So you're doing 200 revolutions now instead of 180. And you'd open up the big throttle, big instead. And the ERA was in charge of the engine room. And you'd have a stoker down there, and he'd be going around doing all sorts of other jobs and so forth, etc. And it was a similar idea, except that it was more modern. You know, it's turbines as well, you see.
And much smaller.
That's right, but more efficient. And the top speed of the harvester was about 30 knots, just over 30 knots. And they looked nice ships, you know, to look at them. But it's like everything else. You don't. When my wife first came on board to have a look, now and again, they'd let. When we were in Liverpool, and we'd only be in probably for a couple of days, and they'd allow visitors on board, but they'd all have to be, you know, go past the police checks. And it's and when I can never forget the first time my wife and somebody else, one of the other wives, came on board, they nearly had a fit. So six of you got to live in. They couldn't believe it. I mean, it wasn't big enough for one, but there you are. I mean, that was it. See, so that was it. But we had a very, at the time, we had a very affable captain. It was a lieutenant commander.
Do you remember his name?
Yeah, Thornton. Mark Thornton. He's dead now. And he was, he couldn't have been much older than me at the time. He was very young. He was probably. How old would I be? 1940. I was nearly 22. I think he could only have been about 27.
And what was he like? Why was he a good captain or affable, you know?
Because he was a pleasant sort of a person. He wasn't one of these people who shout and bawl and ordered everybody around just because he was, he didn't think he was a great. He knew what he was doing. And I'll give you an example of what he did. And to this day, I couldn't imagine anybody else doing it. The captain of a ship had his own personal steward, you know, would take his lunch or drink up onto the bridge, if he was up on the bridge, and that would normally be an able seaman or something like that, you see. Well, on this particular occasion, we were just south of Iceland, I'm trying to think what year it was. Was it 1940 or 41?
It's anyway. All right, we'll come to it, you yeah, know, I mean, but, yeah. but tell a story about him, you yeah. know, isn't...
Right, we were just south of Iceland, and there's some very, very rough seas as well, and we'd had occasions where one or two people had been washed overboard from the seas, and his personal steward was washed overboard. And but he was up on the bridge and he saw it. And he dived off the bridge without giving it an instant's thought, and he still had his duffel coat on to try to rescue this chap, and he got within reach of him, but unfortunately he didn't get him, and then he was in trouble then. But of course in the meantime the boats were being lowered and they got him all right, but there you are, without thinking about anything, he dived off the bridge in a rough sea south of Iceland. I can't think of anybody else that I know would have done that.
What other officers? Do you remember any other officers aboard the ship?
I'm just trying to think. Oh, yes. The engineer officer, that's remember.
What was his name?
Palmer. His name was Palmer. And he...
A lieutenant.
That's it. He was a lieutenant, Palmer. And he was a very benign sort of a person, but he was, you know, a bit of a...
Drinker.
In the wardroom most of the time. And he got promoted to a lieutenant commander while we were still on there at the Palmer. But he was... you got the impression that he would let the chief ERA run the ship. You know what I mean? The engineering department. And because he didn't... although he was a lieutenant commander, everybody wondered how the hell he ever got there. But he was very affable, so everybody liked him from that point of view. So his name was Palmer. Oddly enough, it must have been about... he left the ship before we were, you know, we were sunk. We got another engineer officer on board. Oddly enough, this Palmer, about 10 years afterwards, I met him in Plymouth, actually, and he was a commander by this time, and he recognised me, and I recognised and he still didn't look any different. I thought, how the hell did this chap ever make commander? I never know, but he did. He didn't get any higher, but anyway, he was a nice person, but what he knew about engineering could be written on the back of a second-class postage stamp. That was not just my impression, everybody's. Anyway, there you are, that's the way it goes. So where are we up to now? Let's think.
What about any other officers you remember?
Not really. Oh, vaguely, the gunnery officer. He was a warrant officer, but only vaguely. The main reason I remember him is that during the course of this, I think this was in 1940, before the convoys were organised, and we were out with the Highlander,